Well, let me ask you some questions about Chairman Martin. Martin was of the old school, at least relative to your new class school. He'd come up through the financial markets and had an understanding of how financial markets worked and saw monetary policy through the optic of the psychology of the markets. You were of the newer generation of quantitatively trained economists, knowledgeable about model building, econometrics, and so on.
Not really econometrics. That was beyond me.
Well,
I was a general economist. I come from a bank too, you know.
Yeah. Okay. But you had the interface between a staff that was increasingly technically competent, and between this generation represented by Chairman Martin. And although this didn't occur on Chairman Martin's tenure, there's a memo I pulled out just for sort of the amusement value now, although it probably wasn't funny to you at the time. In November 1972, Governor Sheehan visited your shop and apparently wasn't overly impressed by the anti-war posters he saw on some of the other sorts of pictures, and so you were...
Might have been a few people on sandals and that kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah, so you were obviously interfacing between two different cultures. What did the staff...
Well, Sheehan was not really the old culture, you know. He came in from a management group and was a very difficult personality. So he really wasn't at all like them. The better example is Governor Shepherdson. You remember Governor Shepherdson?
Yes.
Well, I recall that we used to give chart shows to the Open Market Committee, and they included forecasts. And so you'd have a chart, you know, a time series chart with maybe 5 or 10 back years, and then the next 4 or 6 quarters of projection. And one time, Shepherdson says, well, he noticed one thing about these charts, that the right-hand side of it was much smoother than the left-hand side. He wondered why that was. That's a good indication of the difference in cultures, I think.
Martin would make statements like, oh, you know, no more economists, and yet he did support efforts to develop a highly trained staff. Why do you think what that was?
Well, I think he realized that his advantage was in having a staff that was qualified and could present some information to him that was useful.
Mm-hmm.
It was a point of view. It was the broad-minded point of view that Martin had. Although I think you're quite right that he wasn't statistically or certainly empirically oriented in that way. His favorite stories would be what he learned when he talked to people in the lines at the box office in New York.
yeah, that's what Dewey Dane told me.
Yeah, he'd go up and down, talk to people about what did they think. And that was a crazy thing, you know. I wondered what in the world must these people have thought? This guy going up and down asking them what they thought about the economy or how things were when they were standing in line to buy a ticket to some Broadway show.
Well, what did you think of Martin as a monetary policy maker? Did you think of him as old-fashioned, or did you see him as having an intuition about policy that made up for a lack of training in economics?
Well, he was, you might say, we used to distinguish in those old days between the banker school and the economist school, and he was more of the banker school.
Mm-hmm.
But his practical banking experience and a banker point of view, which many of the board members had at that time.
Mm-hmm.
toward these issues, and that's not necessarily wrong. It's not old-fashioned even, and as far as I can see, it might have worked out just as well as any other approach. He did have some intuition, I think, but he also had a very wide range of acquaintances that gave him a sense of things that you didn't get looking at the statistics or the publications. And I think
the board did change in the 1960s. The banking school individuals, Balderston and Shepherdson, Dewey Dane, of course, he stayed into the 70s. But that school, on the other side, you got Brimmer and Maisel and Mitchell. Did that make a difference?
Yeah, there was a change. There was a change. I don't remember too clearly. There was a whole change in the position of the board. The board used to consider very small things in board meetings, mm-hmm. which they had every day, and which would end in time so that Mark could go play his game of tennis.
Mm-hmm.
But for example, one thing I recall, I don't know why it sticks in my mind, is that there was an exception to labor rates that always had to be approved for the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, having to do with the pay of marble cutters in Chicago. Well, that's something the board took up every 6 months or something like that. And there were many little bits of trivia of that kind that used to be in board meetings, and they all dropped out over time. And so the character of the thing did change significantly with the passage of time.
Well, Burns changed that too, right? I mean, one of the first things he did was to make all the administrative responsibility for the staff subject to his approval as opposed to the entire board.
That certainly happened without my knowledge, and I don't know quite what it involved, but apparently prior to that time, the chairman didn't have a stated authority as great as that Burns insisted on when he came in,
mm-hmm.
and it did involve total ability to control administratively the staff of the board, which I guess wasn't there before.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think all the promotion decisions and so on were considered by the entire board.
That's right, and you know they were afterwards too. I can't really think of the changes that occurred, but it seemed to people to be important in terms of the written policy.
Hmm. So that when decisions were made, for example, to promote you to be director of research, that was considered by the entire board. That was
really?
that was not Burns's decision.
No.
Hmm. That, okay.
Well, as a matter of fact, I became director of research before Burns came.
Right.
But just before. But no, I think my recollection, and later on when I was a board member, was that the questions of promotions to official staff, at least,
mm-hmm.
always considered by the board as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about Martin's attitude toward inflation in 1969. Martin felt like monetary policy had been too easy. We talked about that before, the business about the income tax surcharge and how late that was getting through Congress and so on. And monetary policy was restrictive in 1969. Do you think Martin was willing to put the economy through a recession if that's what it required to get the inflation rate down?
I don't know. Nothing ever got.
Sure, that would never be stated,
in those
of course.
Specific terms.
Sure.
And I really don't know. I don't think he had anything like the willingness to do it that Volcker did later on.
Mm.
but he would have been more of a compromiser all around, I think. You know, get a little on inflation, get a little on employment, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about relative to Burns? Burns agreed with the gradualist policy of the Nixon administration, which meant primarily the Fed could concern itself with inflation, but that the unemployment rate should not rise much above 4%. So in terms of the continuum, Burns was more concerned about unemployment and the kind of the byproduct of getting unemployment down through a rise in getting inflation down through a rise in unemployment?
That's probably right. I'm not really all that clear about that, because I don't know that much about Martin's views.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as Burns was concerned, one of the great things that whole period, and perhaps until recently, has been the fact we did have the Employment Act of 1946.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to testify on that, and you know, we had people like Wright Patman in the Congress who were very, very critical of the Federal Reserve for its tendency to let employment drift. And he had to testify many times, and you know, sometimes it came very close to a vote in Congress that would have lost that authority, that flexibility for us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was probably the major concern that he had, rather than anything about the administration.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. This is a very general question, but it seems to come through in reading things about Burns. Burns, when he became chairman, saw a country that was divided very deeply over race issues. There was the culture issue, there was the war issue. Burns felt like the country could not withstand a major recession, a high unemployment rate, that given the divisions and the social tensions that already were existing, the country just couldn't handle a recession. Does that sound right?
I think you're reading too much into it.
Okay.
The Burns' principal characteristic was that he was a scholarly academic type economist, schooled in the business cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had a feeling of all these things interacting. And so he was more aware, I think, than his predecessors had been, that action that will limit prices would probably raise unemployment and vice versa. But it was from a business cycle orientation rather than any social thing. I don't remember social issues being much discussed in those years, in the board anyhow.
Sure. Toward the end of 1969, it looked like the economy was beginning to weaken. It must have been a very confusing time, though. The unemployment rate went to 4%, I think, in October. I guess that would have been seen in November, but it then drops back down to 3.4% in December, and it's not really until, March or so, or April of 1970, that it begins to look like the unemployment rate is climbing above 4%. But there's evidence toward the end of 69 that the economy is weakening, and at that point there's a division of opinion within the FOMC. You have doves like Bremer, Mitchell, and Maisel, and then you've got hawks, Martin, Hayes, and presidents like Coldwell. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I'm not sure about the timing, but that does sound like the way the thing would line up as we started to see some weakening. But my recollection is that we weren't all that concerned about a weakening in the economy in late '69.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably that came a little later. We tended to be a little late in seeing changes in the economic environment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we were probably a little late then. And, of course, a lot was contributed by the Penn Central crisis in 1970.
In a sense of urgency?
A feeling that the financial structure was a little shaky, weak.
Mm-hmm. So
that would be made worse by a decline in the economy.
So there was that caused a significant change in attitudes.
Yeah, that was probably late spring of 1970.
Yeah, it was May of 1970.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was a feeling that monetary policy was stressing the financial system, the level of interest rates.
That's right. It became much more of an issue. Because, you know, it wasn't just Penn Central. It was a commercial paper market that virtually collapsed on us.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had all these... were these things that used to develop that people didn't know much about until they happened. There had been this culture, this tradition to always have your commercial paper backed by lines of credit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at that time we discovered that many of the big issuers didn't have enough lines of credit to cover. And so not only was it a question of a coming back on the banks, but of the banks being able to say no because there wasn't an established line of credit. The people like Chrysler
mm-hmm.
was a major player then. And there were these demand notes, what they called demand notes, that were issued by the commercial paper issuers that might have said 60 days or 90 days, but they were callable on 24 hours notice.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a common trust instrument. Trust departments bought them in volume. And so it became a very shaky thing. And so, as I say, there was, and then of course you needed to have more bank credit to support the decline in the commercial paper market, to substitute some other credit for the credit that used to go through that. And so that became a big consideration. And that seems to stick in my mind more clearly than any serious, really serious recession talk before then.
Banks weren't naturally ready to step into the breach and get the business that had been going elsewhere. This was not a great business opportunity for them, or they were timid about it?
Well, you know how it is when there becomes a credit, the question about the credit
mm-hmm.
business, why banks become reluctant.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were being presented with this opportunity, you might say, at the very time that the credit worthiness of the borrower came into question.
Mm-hmm.
And so they weren't all that enthusiastic, no.
So were you involved in the firefighting, calling banks and...
Yeah. I didn't actually call banks. The presidents did that. But I was involved in the dealing with that crisis, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So basically the bank presidents would call on the phone and say, the discount window is open if you get unusual
really
credit demands.
Prior to an open market meeting. And and they all called leading banks in their districts
mm-hmm.
to say that they would be supported, that the Federal Reserve would be supportive as credit was extended to substitute for this commercial paper.
So it was the peak of the business cycle is dated December 1969.
It was, right. I agree with that.
It was a mild recession, but kind of reading the documents, my recollection is up through June of 1970, the Council of Economic Advisors was not particularly concerned about recession. They saw weakness rather than recession. It wasn't until now that you mention it, about that time, that...
I think that's right, you see. I mean, it was the commercial paper crisis that focused everyone's attention. And that was at about the time you were getting more signs of weakness in the economy, too. And so they came together
mm-hmm.
in the spring and summer of 1970.
Mm-hmm. One thing that appears in the documents is a debate between the Fed and the Council of Economic Advisors on the language in the economic report of the president having to do with monetary policy. In particular, the Council states very explicit goals with respect to the unemployment rate, the kind of thing you just mentioned. And then apparently the McCracken Council wanted to make explicit assumptions about monetary policy, and that was debated back and forth between the board and the council. Who would have done that sort of negotiating with the council? Would that have been Bob Holland? Or?
Well, it would have basically been Burns.
Okay.
But people who represented Burns in that, with myself and Lyle Gramley.
Okay.
That was an unusual thing, too, because mm-hmm. As I recall, the magic number was 1065. And And the question was, well, what do you have to do to get a GNP of 1065? Mm-hmm. And the council's answer to that was, all you have to do is provide a particular monetary policy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all based on a sort of the back of the envelope econometric model that Laffer, who was a sort of a protege of Schultz's, had developed, saying that the effect on GNP of monetary policy was immediate, and this was demonstrated by the on-seasonally adjusted figures. Mm. And that was all that was required. And, you know, that was almost brought by the council. And if it hadn't been for McCracken's willingness to compromise and to meet the objections of Burns, that would have come out in the report, that 1065 was an easy thing to achieve given a particular monetary policy. And that got taken out of the report.
Yeah, I remember that. I was a graduate student at the time, and Laffer had been an assistant professor at the business school at Chicago, and here was this regression of not seasonally adjusted GNP and not seasonally adjusted.
And he was with money. I think with the Budget Bureau at the time.
Yeah, he was working for
Schultz, I guess.
For Schultz, but even so, I mean, Schultz wanted then 6% M1 growth. McCracken wanted 7 or 8% M1 growth. Stein wanted whatever it took. Burns said, you know, forget all the numbers, it's really the confidence of the businessman that counts. And so at that point there was a very public debate between Burns and the council, which Nixon finally ended in June. But let me ask you about that. When the council first came out with the 1065 number, the board staff was skeptical. It was considerably above standard forecast at the time.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And we were particularly skeptical of the model that Laffer had. And as a matter of fact, there used to be an econometrician at the board named Jim Pierce. You remember Jim Pierce?
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure.
Well, he spent quite a bit of his time that summer developing a critique of the Laffer model to show that it couldn't be true. I mean, yeah. It was a fairly large enterprise on the part of the research department to deal with this critical thing. And again, you need to understand it's trying to pin the Fed with the responsibility for a particular outcome based on a particular policy that was objectionable here. And that, particularly in the context of the Employment Act of 1946. I mean, if the administration were to say, all we need to do to get this favorable outcome is have this monetary policy, which involved a particular increase in the narrow money supply, then that would make the Federal Reserve fully accountable to the Congress under the Employment Act. But we just couldn't have that. We just couldn't have that occur.
Well, the same, this jumps way ahead, but the same issue exactly came up with the Humphrey Hawkins debate, that Senator Humphrey and Representative Augustus Hawkins wanted to make 4%, you know, legislatively the official
target. Yes, that's right.
And then
the target.
And then the Federal Reserve System then was, its job was to be to kind of estimate whatever it took in terms of money to growth to get that 4%.
A lot of people forget that was such a big issue in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And you remind me when you were talking about 1969, that indeed we did have quite low unemployment rates through 1969. As I remember, as a matter of fact, we were the wonder of the world with those very low unemployment rates. And they disappeared, but not before they became a major cause. For debate in Congress. And the Humphrey Hawkins testimony came out of that, the two times a year appearance of the chairman.
Right, right. I mean, the performance...
I think that was the compromise, that rather than adopting some rule and live into that by why the Federal Reserve would testify twice a year as to its intentions and how it thought things were working out.
Right. The 3.4% unemployment rate that you got in December, that was like a benchmark. That was everything was judged against, and it was unrealistic, and that was sort of always in the background.
So I hadn't remembered that, but that was a strange. That must have been an aberration. Drop like that in that 1 month.
Well,
I mean, it had been a little above four, and it suddenly dropped to 3.4.
Yeah.
Strange change.
Yeah.
You get that much.
Yeah, and it came. It only began to move up slowly in 1970. So, I think that that was one reason why monetary policy was restrictive in 1969. Is that the economy looked very strong. At least, I mean, the labor markets seemed very very strong. Let me ask you about Burns's attitudes toward economic recovery and incomes policies. Your mention of 1065 brings up the subject in that Burns had advocated some form of relatively mild incomes policy as early as May of 1970, but the serious discussion of an incomes policy began, I believe, in December 1970 with his Pepperdine speech. It looks like what you get is the administration's policy of achieving 1065, pressure on the Fed, and then Burns responds and says, look, there's only so much monetary policy can do. We've got this, you want a monetary policy that will promote economic recovery, and we're in agreement with that, but there's only so much we can do as long as wage rates are rising at inflationary levels. So it looks like from the record that that's the point where you begin to get a serious discussion and kind of debate back and forth between the Nixon administration and the Fed over the role of incomes policies. Is that right? December 1970?
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I don't remember the dates just exactly, but it's certainly true that incomes policy became a major consideration around then.
Mm-hmm.
And again, let me remind you, now, because it is an old thing, incomes policy was very popular in the world at that time. Many countries had incomes policy goals, and indeed the OECD had a subcommittee on incomes policy that met regularly and discussed ways to work it and to regulate income. So it was much, much more popular in those days than it is now.
Right, but in the United States, I mean, it seems like the key, you're right, as far as the OECD countries goes, incomes policies are a standard part of the economic apparatus throughout the 1960s, and of course, even in the United States, you get the guideposts from 1962 on. But as far as this period is concerned, it seems like what was key was the fact that in 1970, you begin to get a rise in the unemployment rate. The unemployment rate moves up to 6%, ultimately stays there until whatever early summer of 1972, and doesn't seem to have any effect on the inflation rate. The inflation rate just seems to be stuck up there at 6%, and that, my impression is that just caused an enormous amount of soul searching and distress within the economics profession, that how could you get this rise of unemployment above 6% and not get a fall in the inflation rate? And 99% of the economics profession went to the view that this is cost push in inflation. So it was, that was a view within mainstream economics. Within the Nixon administration, it was certainly the view at the Treasury. And I think it's fair to say that within the board staff too, that was the standard interpretation of that, what I guess was later called stagflation.
Yeah, well, and I remember it was the beginning of the ratcheting up of the full employment price stabilization rate, whatever they call that. The Phillips curve was reevaluated, and it was decided that unemployment really had to be higher as a result of that experience in the early 70s.
Right, but that only came very slowly. That didn't come until, 73, 74, right? I mean, at this point, there was almost, looks like to me, going back and looking, there was, in the year we're talking about now, 1970, 1971, 1972, there was almost complete consensus within the economics profession that 4% unemployment was a pretty good objective.
Yeah, that certainly was true.
And within the Fed, governors like Andy Brimmer thought it was an interim goal. He thought that eventually, you know, policy ought to push unemployment below 4%. At least that's what he said a number of times.
Well, I think that's right. 4% was a touchstone.
Mm-hmm.
No question about it.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, everyone reluctantly gave ground on it simply because there wasn't much that could be done as the employment rate went up above that. Probably the most reluctant were people like Brimmer and Mitchell.
Mm-hmm.
And those who were more willing to accommodate it were the remaining banker members of the board who said, well, that's life, you know.
Say that again, please. The banker members were closer to the business community, and the business community, they were really the driving force ultimately behind price controls, because they wanted the government to restrain the demands of unions for wage increases. What wasn't that?
Speaking of the unemployment rate target, the price control question,
yeah,
developed a little more gradually and a little later.
Mm-hmm.
Basically in 1972.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, that was foreordained. I remember we used to have informal seminars in the research department about the efficacy of price and wage controls and how they might be and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
For long before the administration had a program on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, within the administration, it was primarily Schultz and McCracken who opposed the controls, but beyond that, there was considerable support for them.
Oh, yes, that's right. And there was, the foreign element was a part of it, too, the uncertainty about the dollar and all that. So, as a matter of fact, it seems to me that little crisis in 72 was principally a question of the dollar's declining, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, that was a key.
The thing that brought it on at that dollar, particular point in time.
Yeah, the dollar was overvalued, and something had to be done about it, and that sort of forced action. And if the dollar's overvalued, one thing you can do about it is restrain domestic inflation, and
mm-hmm.
the wage controls seem, you know, work. Well, as part of an overall package. Let me ask you a little bit more about Burns. Burns, of course, was a very eminent economist, but he was not a mainstream economist in the sense that he never signed on to a Keynesian model or a monetarist model. He was his own sort of NBER.
Yes, that's right.
He would say
that he was mainstream, and that the others were were out of tune. But he was a business cycle economist, National Bureau Associated. You know, he was a very, very good friend of Milton Friedman.
Yes, I know about that.
Milton Friedman fully expected that there would be a monetary approach to policy when Burns was made chairman. And I think one of his great unhappinesses was that that never occurred, because Burns was never prepared to accept rigid rules, which, of course, at that time, Friedman was all for.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is part of our discussion, but in terms of, it wasn't that Burns didn't, I mean, there was, constant discussion about money, but Burns emphasized the velocity part. Burns, for Burns, what drove things was the confidence of the businessman and their willingness to invest. And if you had that confidence, then velocity would expand, and that's where most of the action would be, rather than in the quantity of money. So it wasn't that Burns wasn't looking at money, it was more that he was emphasizing the velocity part and Friedman was emphasizing the quantity.
Yeah, Friedman took the position that velocity was unchanging.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yes. Therefore, entirely a matter of the money increases.
Mm-hmm. Burns wanted to promote economic recovery, particularly 1970, 1971, when it became clear that there had been a recession, and the fourth quarter of 1970 was a problem. The auto strike added to the problems of the recession. But Burns, I mean, for him, the issue was, how do you restore the confidence of the businessman so he begins to invest? Well, the businessman has to see profits down the road, but if he's going to see profits down the road, he's got to see, the businessman has to be able to control his costs. He's got to have the feeling that he can control wage increases. And that caused Burns to emphasize the incomes policy.
I think that's a reasonable view.
Mm-hmm.
It's said more specifically than anybody ever did at the time. But I think it's a reasonable hypothesis to operate on.
And Burns also, from a point of view of where he felt comfortable on boards of directors talking to businessmen. So he had that perspective in terms of where you came down. He was hostile toward the unions in that sense, thought they were aggressively trying to push wages beyond levels that would, that were compatible with price stability, and so there was a tension always between kind of Burns on one side and Meany and kind of organized labor on the other side. That was part of the, at the time, the general environment, the sort of what we talked about earlier, the divisions in this case between business and organized labor. Burns just felt more comfortable with the business community, and that was sort of his source of support. Does that sound fair?
I think that's probably right, although I must point out to you that we used to have meetings of the economists, academic economists, and we had many a meeting with people like Dunlop and so forth who were talking about labor objectives. And there was an effort to keep that channel open, but I don't think it ever was as comfortable as the relationship with business and finance.
Mm-hmm. So Dunlop, he was a labor... had he been at Harvard and he was a labor negotiator, and then he came in with the Cost of Living Council? And
yeah, I guess he had been at Harvard. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of them. There was another who was out at Pittsburgh who was prominent for a while. That was probably later. Dunlop was the first one. Mm-hmm. And we used to have, in the program for academic economists, there were subjects. And you'd invite people in. to lead the subjects. I can remember labor discussions, and they often were led by people who had this industrial organization background.
Mm-hmm.
Of whom Dunlop was, I guess, the leading example. Who was the guy? Oh, Arne Weber was at Pittsburgh.
Oh, that's right. He was Carnegie Mellon.
That's right.
He had been at the Chicago Business School when Schultz was dean, so he was sort of a protege of George Schultz.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then when Schultz came to OMB, I guess at that time he brought Weber in to work with him.
For a while, although my main recollection of Weber is as an academic appearing at Washington.
Let me ask you a little bit about your working with relationship with Arthur Burns. When Burns came in February 1970, he was obviously an eminent economist, but had not studied the Fed. His own work had been on the business cycle rather than financial policy or monetary policy, so that as eminent as he was, he still needed to learn the ways of the Federal Reserve System, how it worked, how policy got made, and so on. Who worked with him primarily when he came in? Did you have immediate contact with
him?
Yes,
I did. I did. And Lyle Gramley was his speechwriter.
Mm-hmm.
And had a lot of contact with him. And it was a little bit treacherous for the staff to have this fellow come in from New York with a lot of possible additions to the board staff if he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
It was a question of getting that all worked out, which we did pretty well with him. And it probably was because he felt a bit uncomfortable in the financial and monetary side. Steve Axelrod was also a monetary economist at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And dealt with Burns, but I would say principally it was Gramley and myself.
Mm-hmm. So you developed very quickly a good working relationship with Burns, and that was any reasons why you just had a natural you could understand sort of how he looked at the world, and would you argue back and forth about things? Debate and
talking about these little seminars we used to have within the research department.
Mm-hmm.
Well, often Burns was the invited guest, and he would come up, and we would all go right to it with Burns at the table to discuss these issues, and we had a good relationship with him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he was a very dominating personality,
mm-hmm.
and in the end, I would never want to argue that there was anything that was put into his mouth that he wasn't willing to have come there.
Mm-hmm.
But he was pretty good in discussions, better than you would think, looking at his public personality.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about your working relationship with him in terms of FOMC presentations. I visited the Ford Library at Ann Arbor and looked through Friedman's notes. So apparently, you know,
through his notes?
I'm sorry, through Burns's notes.
Oh.
Burns's papers. So apparently the way you worked for FOMC meetings is that you would write out briefing notes for Burns before the meetings, and you would go over what you thought individuals like Alan Holmes would talk about, and then you would suggest a line of argument for his statement, and then he would take that those briefing notes, and then he would go back and work off them. It doesn't look like he ever, you know, just completely discarded them. Looks like what he did primarily was to edit them and, you know, off your copies. Is that right? I mean, you must. So it sounds like you worked pretty closely with him from the beginning.
Yeah, you're making it a little more personal, I think, than it was. Mm-hmm. Of course, the staff was deeply engaged in preparing material for the open market meetings.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it was for the board as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
The person who took the greatest interest was Burns. So there was more deep involvement with Burns than with other board members
mm-hmm.
on the thing. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a little too glorious to say that we prepared briefing notes for Burns, but we did have background material which he used.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know that, you know, you mentioned Alan Holmes. I can't remember Alan Holmes ever having a function with the committee that would lead it in any way. He was very much an operator.
Mm-hmm.
He did what the committee told him to do.
Sure. I was just referring to the sort of standard for where there would be a...
Charlie Coombs might have had more of an independent role.
Right. There would be a summary of the desk actions, and then as you said, there'd be an international, and initially that was Charlie Coombs and later Bob Solomon, and it looks like then Burns gets some, you know, notes on what's likely to be covered in those briefings.
Yeah, he might have, yes. And I think, you know, you mentioned Bob Holland earlier. I think Bob Holland might have provided himself, too. I didn't mean to slight that relationship at all, because Bob was a very close assistant to Burns.
Mm-hmm.
And in a wide variety of things, administrative as well as policy-oriented. And so there might have been notes that were provided to him, but one doesn't think of Burns as the kind of a person.
Sure, that goes without saying, but it looks like from the material that's available that he went into the FOMC meetings with a lot of preparation, and he pretty much knew where he wanted to come out at the time of, you know, when he went into. You can look at it either way. He did his...
I think that's right. You know, one of the differences in the Open Market Committee was that when Martin was chairman, Martin spoke at the end after
mm-hmm.
everybody else had indicated their position. Burns spoke first.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty notable.
Mm-hmm. And then you had an important role in FOMC meetings too. At key points, when there was issues were hanging and there was division, at times Burns would turn to you and ask your opinion, and you would make statements. Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm. That's true.
So that it was more than the sort of the way the format is now, is that there's a standard set of presentations that commence the FOMC meeting, and then that's it. The staff's, you know, I mean, except on rare occasions, you know, the staff sort of just fades off. But there were times when you were actually kind of involved as a participant in the discussions.
And we were fairly active participants, not just mm-hmm. myself, but informed staff that might be there.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, when Burns turned to me for a comment on something, I might well refer to somebody else,
mm-hmm.
Like Gramley or maybe Jim Pierce or maybe Axelrod, for a professional view of the matter under
mm-hmm.
discussion.
Mm-hmm. That one of the... I haven't done a lot of interviewing yet for the later period when you become governor. I just talked to people a little bit. But everybody says you were a very effective governor, that you were very effective in terms of influencing the debate and how the committee would come out. And that experience as a staff member at this point, that must have been very valuable to you later on when you became a governor. I mean...
Yeah, I would say it was just one thing melded into another.
Mm-hmm.
After a while, I moved out of the research division, and and was we had an office for monetary and economic policy, and I was head of that. Still exists.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll come back to that in just a second. The decision to go to wage price controls in August of 1971, the period before that, spring of 1971, the economy was not growing strongly, it was not recovering strongly, and there was a lot of concern about the real economy and balancing growth off against inflation, and the money growth, which had appeared to sort of be stagnating at the end of 1970 and early 71, then revives very strongly, moves to, percent by spring and late summer of 71.
And we might have had a revision in the statistics there, too.
Mm-hmm.
We were plagued by that in the early 70s. They were almost always on the upside.
Mm-hmm.
And they came as a surprise, but had to be accommodated.
Mm-hmm. The financial markets then apparently become nervous in sort of May, June of 1971. Bond rates start going up. So the administration is getting significant M1 growth, which it wanted. Apparently, it always wanted more than it was getting.
That's probably true.
then in early July of 1971, the Council of Economic Advisors does its forecasts of the economy, and it's gloomy in that they aren't on the 1065 path, and they don't appear to be on a path that's going to bring the unemployment rate down to 4.5% by summer 1972, which was the acknowledged objective within the administration. So there's a feeling that they're not on path. Policy has to become more expansionary. On the other hand, you've got financial markets that are becoming concerned about high money growth, high inflation. You've got continued high wage growth. And this is the environment that kind of makes the Nixon administration susceptible to rethinking its policy about wage and price controls. If you're going to have policy that's going to encourage recovery and push the unemployment rate down, what are you going to do about rising bond rates, about militant labor unions that are demanding high wage increases? You've got a postal strike at the time. Does that sound like the kind of background that pushed the Nixon administration into the controls? I mean, what recollections do you have at the time?
I think you're about right. I mean, the cost price pressure was intensifying, and it seemed very difficult to deal with. And in addition, I would again mention, it was either a weakness in the dollar or we were losing gold. I can't remember what it was that contributed to the, in the end, to the meeting at Camp David that led the wage price controls.
Mm-hmm. Well, the mark was floated in May, I think, for a while. There was a rising current account deficit, so it was becoming pretty clear to the staff by late spring and early summer that the dollar was overvalued and something was going to have to happen. That the Treasury had just sort of been putting off, but it was becoming clear that something would happen. From reading the documents, though, my impression is that the Nixon administration was talking, at least when I mean Shultz and Connally, and Nixon, that they were talking seriously about controls in most of July, but they were always afraid that once you put on the controls, labor would challenge them and the thing would break down, you'd have a strike and the government wouldn't be able to enforce its guidelines, so that they were talking about early 72. And then what happened, and maybe this will ring a bell with you or not, but the there were wage negotiations with the steel union that resulted in inflationary wage settlement, and the fear that would spread. Steel was viewed as the bellwether at that time, and a fear that wage increases and then the resulting price increases on steel would spread to other industries. So at that point, the decision was made to go to controls, but in fall of 1972, but then the dollar crisis forced everything, and ultimately the controls were announced on August 15th. That's
72?
71.
71, yeah. Well, I could have been a year off. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. There was certainly growing concern throughout the period about the cost pressures. And you know, you speak of these settlements in a particular industry like steel. Well, steel has ramifications all over the place. I mean, there are a lot of people that the steel workers had organized other than steel mills. And you get an increase in the leading contract there, and it spreads all over the place. So that the ramifications of the major settlement, this was also true of autos, you know, they were very much involved in agricultural machinery and trucks and truck engines and that kind of thing. And so one settlement might lead to 50 settlements in a pattern way.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are too high, then everything is too high.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got a lot of cost pressure.
Mm. So the Nixon administration, in a way, felt like it was over a barrel. If it wanted to keep the inflation rate down through standard fiscal monetary policy, it was going to have to go, given the militant labor environment of the time, it was going to have to go through a series of strikes. And that would, in itself, be depressing of economic activity. And if it wanted to continue kind of moving the economy toward recovery, it had to do something about labor. Kind of going through a year of strikes was not just wasn't considered acceptable politically.
Way too destabilizing.
Yeah,
I think that's right.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's right. And of course, you can't have wage controls. They're not acceptable unless you do something on prices.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. The Nixon administration thought that the problem was
the main emphasis was on wage, but prices had to be included.
Well, the argument was, and sort of maybe hard to disagree with, the if you have a cost push inflation and wages are 75% of your costs, you have to start with wage guidelines. And if you're going to have wage controls, then you're going to have price controls to make it acceptable to the labor unions. And of course, that's where the Fed came in, because the unions said, well, price controls, that's got to be interest rates and profits and dividends and
everything else. Oh, that's right.
Then
that came in.
Interest
rates, dividends, and profits.
Mm-hmm.
And so it became a much more complicated system pretty quickly.
Did you have any sense of when Burns moved away from incomes policy to willingness to support price controls, which are, a sort of jump beyond an income policy, which is primarily...
No, I don't really. I think it certainly was mainly a discussion of income policy, but then once you got into the decision making, it quickly became prices too. I wasn't a party to those discussions, and so he went along, and I don't know, and I think it just came out of the discussions with the administration.
Mm-hmm.
summer of 71.
But you were talking about your responsibilities. Your responsibilities did change after Camp David because you became Burns' representative to the Cost of Living Council.
Well, I did do that. I wouldn't say that that was, there was a formal assignment, except that I did that, attended with him or attended in his place the major meetings of the Cost of Living Council and of the wages group. Mm-hmm. Can't remember the name of that now.
The pay board?
Was it the pay board? I might have been, and I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And so I spent a lot of time with that in the fall and winter of 71 and into 72.
Mm-hmm. Were you involved in the design of the control structure, the Cost of Living Council, and the pay board? Were you involved in those discussions?
To a degree. The working group that I was on was chaired by the council, and Herb Stein was the chairman.
Mm-hmm.
And we did get into these things, but the actual structure of the organization, I can't remember. I mean, it quickly became a large bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I don't remember participating in those discussions, except that when you do something, well, then you have to follow through.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, it was quite a few people that were, and I guess the biggest group really became the Cost of Living Council operating group. The pay board was never that big, I don't believe.
Mm-hmm. Is your impression that the major decisions on the structure of the price control administration, the broad outlines, were decided by Schultz and Burns?
I wouldn't be prepared to say that.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that the main outlines were decided by the administration, and I don't know how much of a role Burns would have played in that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you're talking about those things, you ought to include Connally too, because it wasn't just Schultz. Connally was quite important.
I haven't talked to very many people from the Treasury. I have the feeling that
and the representative up there at Camp David for the Treasury was Paul Volcker.
Right. Right. Definitely on monetary issues, Volcker was the key. I mean, on international issues, Volcker was the key person. And I guess Charles Walker must have been important on the domestic.
I'd forgotten about Charlie, but Charlie certainly would have had a voice. But Connally was a strong figure there.
Mm-hmm. Basically, Nixon delegated responsibility for domestic policy to Connally, first of all because he was more interested in foreign policy than domestic policy, and second because Connally was running his re-election strategy, so Connally was...
I guess you're right. Connally became the first economic spokesman, didn't he?
Yes, that's right. That happened in June of 1971. There was considerable debate between open debate between Burns and the administration over the issue of incomes policy, and then there was considerable debate between the council, the OMB, and the Treasury over a variety of issues of how to get 1065, the role of money growth and the role of fiscal policy, and also whether the administration ought to push countries like Japan into revaluing the yen. So then when the Watergate papers came out in June and Nixon decided to crack down on dissent, he wanted to end this public sort of debate about policy, and then he made Connally the spokesman, and then everything had to go through Connally after that. And then Connally was very good at aggrandizing his own power, so by the time Camp David, then he replaced Schultz as the major
That's right.
actor in kind of economic policy.
Phelps did sort of back out, partly I think because he was opposed to the control approach, whereas Connally wasn't.
Yeah, and it must have been that environment too that caused the Nixon attack on Burns in July of 1971. That is, at the JEC, Burns attacked the Nixon administration for being passive on economic policy and pushed for the incomes policy. And then Nixon, through Colson, floated these false rumors about Burns wanting a pay increase.
I'd forgotten that. I had forgotten that altogether. It must not have been all that much moment to me.
Mm-hmm. I think it was a lot of moment to Burns, and Burns won that round. I think in part because he had such good relationships with congressmen, that congressmen like Senator Sparkman were outraged, and Nixon realized he'd pushed too far.
Well, when you get these policy manipulations into the hands of people like Colson and Ehrlichman, God knows what might come out, you know,
mm-hmm.
kind of thing that I don't know that Nixon would have been involved in, except that's what his staff thought of as a way to get it Burns. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember it as being all that big an issue. You're making more of it than I remember.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of what you just said, Burns distrusted Connally's ability to conduct international policy, and that was a factor in the fall of 1971. Do you remember any of the debates that went on over how the Bretton Woods system was going to be reformed at the time?
No, I wasn't really involved in that.
Yeah. What about the Committee on Interest and Dividends? Did you go to those meetings?
Yeah.
Were you involved in that? And that, at this point, did much happen other than letters to corporations telling them to, you know, limit the size of their dividend payments? Was there much action there at all, or was it just sort of?
No, it was a letter writing and oral campaign.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall that we did. We had some people working on the subject and who kept track of dividend announcements and that kind of thing. But I don't believe that it ever became very regularized as a program.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting was mainly an effort to avoid having interest rates specifically covered. I mean, there was at that time a considerable demand to control interest rates by putting limits on them.
Do you have any recollection that when the Economic Stabilization Act was passed in December of 1971, whether at that point there was a real possibility that interest rates would be included in the act?
There was, I think. We came within one vote in the House of losing that.
And that was in the other time this was hotly debated was in when the act came up for renewal in spring of 1973. So the close vote that was in.
I think so. I can check that.
But I think you're probably right. It was probably.
It was a hazard throughout. You know, we again just couldn't hold to an arbitrary interest rate limitation,
mm-hmm.
because it would mean that there's no telling what would occur in terms of balance, in terms of the monetary policy required to support it, and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. But Burns always believed that he could handle that by limiting the interest rate increases, they're spreading them out, that banks charge to politically sensitive groups, small businessmen and farmers, mortgage rates, and as long as the Committee on Interest and Dividends influenced those rates and kept them from increasing too rapidly, then he would be free to move open market rates to the extent that was necessary to make monetary policy.
Yeah, I think that's true. Administered rates were the focus of attention. Mm-hmm. And I would include the prime rate in that.
All right.
And we enlisted the help of the Federal Advisory Council.
Would that have been in fall of 73 with the two-tier prime, or did that come before? Was that sort of ongoing?
Well, I can't remember.
Sure. Well, there are minutes, so I can look that. I can look that up. What do you remember about the two-tier prime in? I guess it was March of 1973. Inflation had begun to move up noticeably, and interest money market rates had begun to move up. The rates banks had to pay on CDs were moving up. Some banks raised their prime rate initially, I guess, in February, and then again in March. And Burns telephoned them, and I can't remember, they either pushed it back or kind of limited the amount of the increase. Do you remember that?
The two-tier prime was an effort to keep rates more stable for small businesses. Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, I don't remember very much about it. No.
Okay, but that was primarily to keep Congress from extending controls over interest rates.
Yeah. Which would be stated in general terms. You know?
Okay. So, did you spend much time on these intergovernmental committees at this time, or was most of your work still of working with the Green Book and doing forecasts and administering the research department?
It was principally that. The main work with the intergovernmental groups was as the thing was being set up in late 71.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was a reduced effort from then on, from our point of view.
Mm-hmm.
We did have these couple of committees that we were responsible for. Non-interest and dividends, principally, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And so that did involve staff input.
Mm-hmm. Under Martin, there was communication between the forecasting staffs of the council and the Fed, but under Burns, there was none of that. You had no contact with any of the rest of the administration economists at this time?
Well, we had the usual weekly meetings with the Treasury. And sometime through there, but I can't tell you just when, we initiated periodic meetings with the Council, too.
So this continued under Burns?
Yeah.
So you met with the staff of the Treasury and Council, the forecasting staff, the economists, or were these just general meetings with other governors?
It tended to be with the principals. I don't know that the technical staffs got together. There was some interplay there, but not a great deal, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. These discussions at these lunches would have been very general sorts of. I mean, you didn't exchange.
Sure.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, without a specific agenda. We might have had an agenda in the early days with the council luncheons, but not with the Treasury. And that had gone back for just years and years, and it was a regular luncheon meeting every Wednesday, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
But the council was more like once a month or once every 2 weeks. And
mm-hmm.
there might have been an agenda
mm-hmm.
in the early days. I just can't remember.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me ask you about monetary policy in 1972, because...
Yeah, we're running out of time here, Bob. It's taken a long time to go through these years. I wouldn't have thought I could have remembered that much about it.
Well, I got a lot of information from you on the 1960s. So you must, I don't know, have you talked, what year did you retire?
86.
86, and so it's been 12 years. Have you talked about monetary policy since then?
Not really.
You really have?
I retired.
Have retired.
I left the board, and I've seldom been back.
Mm-hmm. And it was the grueling character of the work schedule, just sort of the incessant demands on your time, and you just finally decided that you needed to...
Well, I wanted to retire. And I had, as the years went by, because the chairman was so much involved in monetary policy, mm-hmm. I spent more and more time on bank regulatory policy, and then the banking system started to collapse.
mm-hmm.
Well, first the savings and loans, but I guess the first mm-hmm. thing was the farm credit situation,
yeah.
And the oil banks out in Oklahoma and so forth, and Midland, Texas, and then that spun over to the savings and loans, and then finally many, many banks.
Yeah.
It was difficult, so I was quite pleased to be able to get out of it when I did. And I didn't want to be, I didn't want to involve myself with a bank because I couldn't tell what kind of difficulties the bank might get into.
Yeah.
And so I didn't do anything like that.
Well, let me ask you about 1972 and just whatever your impressions are. Burns, because of his involvement in the wage and price controls, I mean, he needed to at least maintain a working relationship with the administration and Congress. He was always very much concerned about the standard at which the price standard and the wage standard in particular. He wanted the wage standard of 5.5% to be lowered over time to work the inflation rate down to sort of finally get the inflationary psychology and kind of behind the country. So I mean, he had to maintain good, at least working relationships with Congress and with the administration.
That's true.
And so Burns himself emphasized sort of the broad factors we talked about, like confidence of the businessman, and particularly he was always very kind of interested in or concerned with fiscal policy measures, investment tax credit, depreciation allowances, kind of thing. But the Nixon administration was focused on M1 growth. That was their, call it obsession, but that was their focus by 1972. So I mean, Burns had to be sensitive to that aspect of
well, I think he was, yes, because you're quite right. There was a constant drumbeat
mm-hmm.
from the administration on keeping the money supply growing.
Mm-hmm.
that was the objective.
Mm-hmm. And so the first time that must have been extremely difficult for Burns, feeling caught between hawks on the FOMC and between the administration, was kind of fall of 71 and early 72, when M1 growth drops off significantly after the controls, and the administration, people like Shultz and at this point McCracken and Stein, are, you know, for them there's a sense of consternation. They can't believe that money growth is falling off. They from their perspective,
it's quite consistent though with the reduction in the pressure of demand for money that mm-hmm. would have occurred as you got a leveling off in prices
mm-hmm.
and wages.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the position we took.
Well, initially, when the weakness appears, and this is October or so, Burns is looking ahead until to spring of 72. He's looking forward to a strengthening of economic recovery, a rise of interest rates at that point, and he argues that if we let rates fall too far now, then we'll have to raise them too much next spring. So initially, he's reluctant to respond to slower money growth with a reduction.
That's right, and we let rates edge up all through 72.
Mm-hmm. But then money growth continues weak in December of 71 and January, February of 72. It does pick up, but it's not, doesn't become clear until later on, I suppose March or April, that it has picked up. So, I mean, Burns is then having to juggle a lot of balls. And in the fall of 1970, the board staff and the New York staff in particular, they're forecasting a revival in M1 growths.
In the fall of 71.
And early 72. So they're forecasting a revival in M1 growth. And according to the procedures at the time where the FOMC would set these benchmark paths mm-hmm. for money growth, and then the board would evaluate them relative to the predictions, there's no pressing need to lower interest rates. It looks like money's going to come back on path. I mean, in fact, that's what happened, but it wasn't obvious at the time that was going to happen.
Yeah, that's right.
So then there's this tension between, or I don't know tension, but there's a vigorous debate at FOMC meetings in December 1971 and January 1972 about how far to push rates down, and Burns is very aggressive, wanting a reduction in interest rates, and sort of has to pull the committee along with him. Does that sound right? Or, I mean, that's not quite right, because Bremer and Mitchell and people like that were always supportive of Burns in this period. Dewey Dane and a number of the presidents, certainly Richmond's president, Aubrey Heflin, was always supportive. But there was a debate.
Yeah. Well, again, remember, you have to remember that some of the principals, including presidents, were money supply people,
mm-hmm.
and they tended to push on it pretty hard. The St. Louis guy, in particular, is there?
Yeah, Daryl Francis.
Daryl Francis. That's it. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was an issue throughout the period.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I don't know how we dealt with it. This was a worldwide thing, too, you know. All mm-hmm. these central banks were running rates of growth versus targets for something or other.
Mm-hmm.
In Germany and England in particular. And we were, too. And you'd fall down low in the range mm-hmm. or even below the range. And then the question would be what to do about it.
Yeah. Okay. But I do want to ask you some of these questions about Burns, because I want to get it right in my history, and there's so much mythology is now developed about this period, and it's developed by people who've not gone back and read the documents, and I want to try to sort it out. The January meeting is the meeting that seems to be the most difficult and ultimately the most controversial. That January 1972, that appears to be the meeting that would much later on be the source of the Fortune magazine article, the Rose thing. You write a statement for Burns, which he pretty much paraphrases. He says, "I can't overestimate to you the importance of achieving promptly a significant upturn in the narrowly defined money supply. It is of critical importance to the system as a political matter. We are coming under increasingly severe criticism in Washington and elsewhere for undermining the president's new economic program." I mean, Burns did have to be concerned about the perception that the Fed was undermining the program that had been set out in Camp David. I mean, that's a fair statement, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he said so. And Is it possible that the person who kind of was the source of the Fortune magazine kind of article information, that he was sitting at the side of the room, and Burns is soft-spoken, he doesn't really hear what Burns is saying, but he's very agitated. He interprets these statements as Burns sort of pulling authority and saying, well, we got to do this because the White House says it. And so by the time this gets through the journalistic
I don't remember. There certainly was the feeling that there was somebody in that room that provided that information.
Mm-hmm.
But we never found out who it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there was too much content to it. I mean, sitting at the table, it seems to me that it was much more judicious discussion of the problem of a declining money supply than was ever suggested in Fortune or in Business Week. I know had an article, and I doubt very much, and I can't recall that Burns ever said, well, the White House wants this or that.
Don't misinterpret me.
Yeah.
I mean, for the most purely self-interested grounds, the chairman is never going to say that, because his whole kind of ability to influence the course of affairs and exert leverage, that comes from his independence. This is what we talked about in the 1065, and, you know, who sets the objectives and the role of the Fed. So, I mean, it's inconceivable that a chairman would ever say that, because it's like he's sort of giving away the source of his authority.
Right.
And I mean, no chairman's going to do it. It's just, but there is these stories did arise, and so I'm trying to figure out where they came from. And my best guess is that the staff member sitting at the side of the room, who was the source of this information, he was feeling very agitated about the sort of imperial way that Burns could exert his authority, and when the references to, you know, the support of the to the need to support the administration's policy came up, that was, he interpreted that as sort of as political pressure, and that's ultimately the way the story came out.
Certainly could be. Now, to be totally frank with you, you know, the only intermediary with the administration really was Burns.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody else. And so only Burns knows what occurred over there. He met from time to time with the president, frequently with they call it a trifa or something.
The quadriad.
Quadriad, yeah. And no one ever attended those meetings except for Burns.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know what occurred, but I don't remember anything like that in a meeting of the FOMC.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Burns did speak low. You know, he was famous for saying that. Somebody would say, well, could you speak up? And he would say, well, when I have something important to say, you'll hear me.
Yeah.
It could well be, and we didn't have a very good system in those days of microphones and all that. And it could be that there was some confusion about what he had said with his pipe and looking down at the table and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that ever occurred. Our concern was there was a decline. And the money supply, it wasn't expected, and it was inconsistent with what everybody thought should occur. But we weren't prepared to go very far to turn the thing around.
Mm-hmm.
So the main impression I have of 1972 as a year is one of increasing interest rates against tremendous opposition from the administration.
Well, Connolly had become the chief spokesman for the administration, and of course he resigned in about June, but that was the critical period. But he was a straight-out Texas populist, and he was opposed to any increase in interest rates.
Probably ever.
Flat out.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Mm-hmm.
And he was right about it. Look what happened to him when he went back to Texas.
Well, I think there were other problems. Yeah, because of the milk. His friendships with the milk lobby caused him some problems.
Yeah, right.
Did you yourself ever get sort of kind of coercive sort of statements by the Nixon people, Colson, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and that group of people? Did you ever have contact with them where they were sort of obnoxious with you?
Very little.
Mm-hmm.
My main contact would have been with people on the council, mm-hmm. not with the White House people.
Yeah.
There was a guy in the White House whose name I've forgotten. Flanagan?
Flanagan.
Yeah.
Pete Flanagan. He apparently interfaced with Burns.
And I did have some run-ins with Flanagan, but not with the others.
Flanagan's still around. You see the name in the New York Times every once in a while. He was from Dylan Reed and then was managed, got financial support for Nixon's reelection committee in the late 60s. And he was always involved, but sort of what role he played is a little unclear. It seemed to be more sort of working out problems. What was your impression of him as an individual? Because his name comes up a lot in these memos, and he obviously talked to Burns a lot.
My principal impression is that he was difficult, opinionated, and didn't know very much.
Yeah, he was not an economist.
No.
Mm-hmm. So,
Pete Flanagan.
Yeah,
but as I say, he was certainly the point. He was sort of second level, but he was certainly the point, a point of contact
mm-hmm.
with the White House.
Mm-hmm. And so you did talk to him occasionally. Or?
Occasionally, yeah, he would come about technical issue. He would come and talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
And which I mentioned before, these revisions in the money supply. We had a big one in '71,
mm-hmm.
and it was hard to deal with. I think it had to do with bankers' checks, London bankers' checks, that we had been missing, and we had to, I think we raised the money supply considerably in the summer of 72, rather.
Yeah, it was on the float that was generated.
Yeah, it was a technical thing.
Yeah, I don't think the staff ever figured out just exactly what was, what the effects were. It was some way of circumventing Reg D by lending over the weekend.
That's probably right.
That generated float, and when the float was deducted from net demand deposits, that reduced the money supply. But nobody ever really sort of figured out exactly how it worked.
Or what it could possibly mean.
Yeah. Well, sure.
That's right.
let me ask you about going into the summer of 1971.
71 now?
72, I'm sorry.
72, okay. We're going to stop pretty soon, Bob.
Okay, I don't, 5 more minutes, 10 more minutes?
Okay.
Won't get much longer. I just want to get through this this business, and then we'll get it behind us. At the end of July, 72, the FOMC got big growth rates for money. For July, and then they changed the two-month target so that you would have a big increase in July, not much in August. But then money growth, even though it did subside, it did continue, picked up in September. So the FOMC was getting money growth over its target ranges, both the two-month benchmark rates and also the six-month benchmark. It was getting estimates like 9% for the third quarter and 7% for the fourth quarter. And Burns did not want the FOMC to raise rates. The FOMC let them drift up a little bit, but not as much as it would have under its regular procedures. What do you think was going through Burns' mind at that point? Do you think it was the kind of thing I was talking about earlier about how he wanted to influence the pay schedule and what the pay guideline was going to be, and in general just didn't want to?
Was of importance in terms of the appearance. And then I also would have to say to you that you have to remember that the fall of 72 we were getting into an election period.
Yeah.
And although one never mentioned those things, I'm sure the same is still true of the Federal Reserve. It likes to keep its head down during these election periods, because it could very easily become the target. And this was, so it was difficult. The timing was difficult.
You know, well, the one thing people ignore when they go back and look at this period was that the policy of an expansionary policy, that was a consensus policy within the political system. There was no, there was the idea that somehow an expansionary policy to promote economic recovery was somehow associated with the Nixon administration. That was not right. There was a general consensus that was the policy should be followed.
That's right. Certainly, it was very true of Congress.
Yes, that's that's for sure. At the September meeting, Burns mentions a couple things. He says that there's a he's having discussions with Congress over a ceiling for expenditures, and if the Fed were to raise interest rates at that point, that would complicate his discussions, because Congress is assuming that if it passes this expenditure ceiling, that will work to keep interest rates down. Does that ring a bell?
Well, that's occurred repeatedly.
Yeah, 68, I know, was in a different context.
Yeah, and it's very possible, because, of course, that would be the period in which you would be discussing limits on expenditures.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always assumed that if you limit expenditures or reduce the deficit, it will reduce interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
Much, much less direct relationship, as you know, than that. But it's the simple way of looking at it. And so the chances are in the early fall of 72 that that was an issue. Let's see, we'd moved by then the October fiscal year, hadn't we?
Yes.
So that we were approaching a new fiscal year.
Mm-hmm. Burns also says that it would an interest rate rise would complicate his role on the Committee on Interest and Dividends, that there's a movement within the committee to have an explicit ceiling on interest rates, and then a rate rise at that point would be a problem for his dealings with the CID. Does that ring a bell at all?
Yes, I would definitely. Was it with the committee itself? I can't remember who exactly was on that committee.
Well, the key member would have been the Secretary of the Treasury.
He was
the nominal head of it. Of course, he would have sent Charlie Walker to the meetings, but at that time, Shultz would have been the head of it. Then there would have been, I guess, the head of the other regulatory agencies, the FDIC and the Comptroller of the Currency.
I doubt it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, but I rather doubt it. It was probably mainly Treasury, and maybe the Council was represented.
Yeah,
it strikes me as being reasonable. You know, if you're trying to limit the increase in incomes, and trying to hold prices, and interest rates are going up,
that's
a rather natural thing for people to say what goes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the difficulties of a control mechanism, sense of balance and fairness and all that, interferes with economics. And so I don't remember it specifically, but I wouldn't be surprised.
I have the feeling that. I-